This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, many people were shocked last year when Robert Champion Jr., the drum major of a legendary Florida College marching band, died after what was described as a hazing incident. Hazing is not something most people associated with a marching band experience. Now, a large group of his fellow bandmates are facing serious consequences. We'll find out more in a few minutes. But first, we want to go from the sidelines to the football field itself. Even though football season is still months away, the NFL was very much in the headlines yesterday. First, the league announced that it is suspending four players without pay for their role in the New Orleans Saints bounty scandal. That's where players were apparently paid for hard hits on opponents. And then just hours later came news about the apparent death by suicide of Junior Seau. He'd played most of his career for his hometown San Diego Chargers. He was picked to play in 12 Pro Bowls. That's the NFL All-Star game. In addition to his on-field exploit, Seau was also famous for his constant smile, outgoing personality, and extensive community service work with children. And now some are raising questions again about whether brain injury may have played a role in his tragic death. We wanted to talk about all of this, so we've called upon two of our regular sports analysts. Pablo Torre is a writer for Sports Illustrated. Dave Zirin is the sports editor at The Nation magazine, and they're both regular guests in our Barbershop Roundtable, which is on most Fridays. Welcome back to you both. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Pablo, let me just start with you. What are your memories about Junior Seau, and what went through your mind when you heard about his death?
I was shocked. I mean, we've seen guys, Dave Duras and Ray Easterling, very recently in the last 15 months commit suicide. But Junior Seau is by far the biggest name, I think, to the casual fan. A superstar, full stop, an elite linebacker, a guy who was the Michael Jordan of American Samoa in some ways. Samoa has produced so many NFL players. He was the guy everybody looked up to. And he was a guy who was pretty much equally beloved in the United States, a guy whose kindness has been remembered in recent hours by pretty much everybody who ever came in contact with him.
Dave Zirin, what about you? What crossed your mind?
Well, obviously, shock was the first emotion to cross my mind. I had met Mr. Seau once, and he had a kind of charismatic gravitational pull that you only find very seldomly, I think, in life. And my first thought, though, was about 2 years ago, a story about Junior Seau driving his car off of a bridge after – off of a cliff, I'm sorry, after being investigated for a domestic violence complaint by his live-in girlfriend at the time. And I thought about that story and remembered that the police took Seau at his word, that he was just asleep at the wheel and it was just a horrible accident and he was fine. And thinking at the time, wow, if there was ever a city that would give Junior Seau a pass, it would be San Diego. And sometimes giving somebody a pass is the most dangerous thing you can do for them.
But you were also telling us earlier, and we've been talking a lot on this program about the whole question of brain injury and the possible connection to suicide. And, you know, obviously we don't know all the details. You know, we don't know whether perhaps any note was left or whether there have been sort of private medical issues that have not yet come to the surface. But the elephant in the room, as Pablo just talked about, was the fact that there have been a number of suicides of NFL players recently. Ray Easterling, who played for the Atlanta Falcons, took his own life a few weeks ago. Last year, Dave Duerson left a suicide note asking examiners to study his brain, and they found extensive signs of damage related to blows to the head. And so, Dave, I just have to ask, whether is that being discussed here? I know the advocates around brain injury issues in the NFL have been talking about this online. I've seen a lot of discussion online. What are some of the reasons why they're talking about this?
Oh, well, one of the reasons why they're discussing it so much is the manner in which Junior Seau took his own life, which was a gunshot to the chest, which is in the exact manner in which Dave Duerson took his own life, very explicitly by Dave Duerson, because he said he wanted his brain to be able to be studied. So to have Seau kill himself in the same manner was something that people immediately raised questions about, like, was he having issues with brain injuries?
And is there a record of concussion? Did he have a record of brain injury that we know about?
This is what was so shocking to me as I was looking into it. Junior Seau played for 2 decades in the National Football League, was known for his ferocious hits. There is not one public note of him being diagnosed with a concussion in all that time. And you see that, you can only draw one of two conclusions. Either Junior Seau was somehow made of magic to be able to go 20 years without getting a concussion in the National Football League, or it just was not reported when it happened, which meant it wasn't treated. Now, whether that happened because of Junior Seau not wanting it to get out or whether it was team doctors, whatever it is, it speaks to the kind of neglect towards the issue of head injuries that's existed in the NFL until recently for all too long.
Pablo, before we turn the page and talk about the other big NFL news today, I wanted to ask whether you see any signs of a cultural shift, perhaps among players, because as Dave indicated, that there's a two-way street here. There are perhaps owners, managers, doctors mm-hmm. who might be invested in not being as aggressive about this, but there are also players who don't want to be taken out of the game. Are you seeing any signs that players themselves are thinking more about this?
Yes. I think the only, there's no better warning than to see a peer, a guy who seems so invulnerable, kill himself. I mean, that's really the only way to get through to an NFL player, I think, to cut past all of the other issues here, the machismo, the stigma of all of that. And I also note, on top of what Dave was saying, was that there's also the other elephant in the room, which is just mental illness. The Venn diagram of mental illness and head trauma, they aren't completely overlapping all the time. We don't know yet what the cause was, but in either situation, whether it was just, quote unquote, just mental illness or CTE, this brain trauma, either way, those are two endemic problems in sports that really need to be addressed.
I'm speaking with sports journalist Pablo Torre, that's who was speaking just now, and Dave Zirin. We're talking about the death of NFL great Junior Seau, apparently at his own hand. We also want to talk about the big suspensions handed out yesterday in the New Orleans Saints bounty case. Dave, you had a final thought
about this? Just a major shift I've seen even in the last 5 years is when I ask NFL players, would you want your son playing this game?
Right.
They all pause now, and many of them say no. That's very different.
Well, so turning the page, even though it really is kind of a related story, the NFL has been handing out big penalties to the New Orleans Saints for the so-called bounty scandal. That's where players were paid bonuses for things like hard hits or even knocking other players out of games. So, Dave, tell us about the latest developments and how are these being viewed within the league?
Suspensions have been handed down to four players who were on that New Orleans Saints team, even though 27 apparently were implicated. Only two of those players still play for the Saints at this time, Will Smith and Jonathan Vilma, who had the stiffest penalty. He's out for the entire season. And Scott Fujita, who has been a very outspoken player on the issue of player safety, has been suspended for 3 games for the Cleveland Browns, as well as a player named Anthony Hargrove, who plays for the Green Bay Packers. Now, it's being viewed like with a lot of shock around the NFL.
And by whom? You mean
by players and the media.
The media.
For two reasons is the big shock. The first is that by all accounts, the players heard about it on ESPN SportsCenter. They weren't informed by the league that they were suspended, and that was seen as quite the slap to the face. And the second thing that really just absolutely floored people was that, according to all accounts, the players never got to see the evidence that had been accumulated against them, and they've all said they're going to appeal, but the appeal is to NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell.
The same person who made the decision. Dave, I know you have an opinion about this. I'm going to go to Pablo first, and then I'll give you a minute to give your opinion about this. Pablo, what's your take on this? Do you think that those are fair? What are you hearing?
I mean, I don't think – well, I guess on the topic of evidence, that's something that I don't know if it could ever be resolved. I mean, I don't think players were receiving receipts. They weren't itemizing bounty payouts on their tax returns. So I don't know if that could ever be produced, which is just adding to the problem. But whether it's fair or not, I think the larger conclusion is that it's in line with what Roger Goodell is trying to do, which is deter this behavior from ever happening again. And I think in that frame of mind – he has no problem suspending Jonathan Vilma for an entire year or Scott Fujita. He's going after guys who are outspoken, who are leaders. That was his stated justification. He wants to target, in an ironic way to use one of Greg Williams, the disgraced defensive coordinator of the Saints, one of his phrases, he's going after the head. He's going after guys who are faces and names and people who are most prominent in an effort to make sure that a bounty program, targeted injuries just don't happen ever again. Now, whether that can happen is another question.
Dave Zirin, I know you have an opinion about this, and you've been very skeptical about this, I guess, putting the onus on players.
Strongly skeptical. I'm skeptical of it for a couple of reasons. I mean, the first is that by many, many accounts, this occurs in a lot of locker rooms around the NFL and has mm-hmm. been a part of the NFL culture for more than a few decades. And coming down this hard on one particular team, the New Orleans Saints, and the players in particular, to me, feels like an effort by Roger Goodell to much more send a message to fans, send a message to people who see the NFL as family-friendly entertainment, and send a message to the legal and judicial community, because right now more than 1,000 former NFL players are suing the NFL because of issues that deal with withholding knowledge about the effects of head injuries. And to me, it's not an honest way to go about the issue, because head injuries in the NFL happen because the sport is football, not because of bounties.
So is there any way to make it safer? Is there any way to – I'm guessing what would be the Dave Zirin approach here if you don't agree with Roger Goodell's?
Well,
briefly, if you would.
I think the right approach has to be a full knowledge and full discussion about what are the effects of actually playing in the National Football League, because that's what we don't have right now. I think Roger Goodell should settle with the players who are suing the league, get that off the table right away instead of fight it to the degree to which that they are fighting it, and that they need to start to address the issue about, okay, what are the real ramifications of playing in the National Football League, so parents with kids and so players can make informed decisions about when they play. Because, I mean, I've just talked to too many retired players who say, if I knew now what I knew then, and that's what I think we want to eliminate.
Yeah, ironically, still the most popular sport in
the NFL
America.
Doesn't want to know. They don't want to know the answer to that. I mean, that's
I was asked for the Dave Zirin way. Okay.
Well, to be continued, Pablo Torre is a writer for Sports Illustrated. He was with us from our bureau in New York City. Dave Zirin is the sports editor for The Nation. He was with us from our studios here in Washington, D.C. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we will hear from a Smithsonian jazz ambassador who wants to change the way audiences hear the harmonica. Frederick Yonne joins us for a performance and conversation and to talk about his new album, Reed, that's R-E-E-D, My Lips. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we want to revisit a disturbing story that highlighted the issue of hazing on college campuses. On Wednesday, Florida State Attorney Lawson Lamar announced that 13 people have been charged in the death of Robert Champion Jr. He is the Florida A&M University drum major who died in November of 2011 after an alleged beating by fellow marching band members on a chartered bus. It's been described as part of a hazing incident, and now 11 of 13 defendants will face felony hazing charges. I talked with Robert Champion's parents, Robert Champion Sr. and Pamela Champion, back in December, and I just want to play a short clip of what Mr. Champion's father had to say in that conversation.
We want to address the problem and let people know that we're going to do all we can to get this hazing thing stopped so no other kid will have to go through what he went through.
We wanted to talk more about new developments in this tragic case, so we've called upon Denise Marie Bologna. She's a reporter for the Orlando Sentinel, has been covering this story. Welcome to the program. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
Denise Marie, could you just briefly remind us of what is alleged to have happened to Robert Champion Jr. on that bus back in November?
After the Florida Classic football game last year, a number of band members and maybe some other people got on board the bus after everyone had already gotten off, and a number of hazing rituals were apparently happened. Robert and one or two other people apparently were trying to complete a ritual known as crossing busee, and went through a number of rituals that included punching and kicking. And at one point, as we understand, there was also a ritual involving suffocation.
In the months since this awful thing happened, authorities have been conducting an investigation that led to the 13 people being charged, but an additional 20 misdemeanor hazing charges were brought against others, some in apparently unrelated incidents. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I'm still trying to get some clarification on those, from what I understand, because there were the other people who went through the hazing, I think there were one or two other students besides Robert who were hazed on board the bus that evening. We're thinking that those, or at least many of those charges, are related to the hazing of those other people.
Now, Denise Marie, you cover higher education, and I think what was shocking about this story for many people is I think many people associate hazing with, you know, fraternities or sororities or, you know, football teams or something like that. I don't think a lot of people, perhaps outside of a few circles, knew that hazing rituals were associated with something like the band. I mean, is this something that you knew about as an education reporter, or are you surprised by this as well?
I had not heard of it before either. Like you said, I had heard about fraternities, sororities, athletic groups involved with colleges, but not in marching bands. But early on, I started getting information about hazing being pretty popular among marching bands at historically Black colleges and universities.
To that end, I want to play another clip from my previous conversation with Robert Champion's parents. And in this clip, Robert Champion's mother addresses the secretiveness of this, or how the secrecy around this. I'll just play that short clip.
We're speaking out because we want to, in my son's name, to be able to put a stop to it, to end all the hazing. Now that the door has been opened and we can see all the things that are behind that door, I think it needs to be cleaned out and stopped.
I understand that in the course of your reporting that you've been speaking to many parents about this so-called culture of hazing. Can you just tell us a little bit more about what your reporting has indicated? For example, is this something that seems to have been going on for many years? Is this a recent phenomenon? Do the kids talk to their parents about it?
It seems to have been going on for a while. It looks like FAMU has been struggling with this problem for a number of years. You know, through public records and conversations with parents, you know, we've learned that a number of families, students, and others have come to the administration complaining about hazing within the band and asking the school to be more aggressive. You know, we know that the on-campus police department has investigated at least 10 cases of hazing involving the band between fall of 07 and late last year. So yeah, we do know that this is something they've been struggling with for a while, and we also know that the university has been taking steps to try to prevent it. I mean, they're having hazing workshops. They're talking to the band every year before school starts. I understand that the band director, who's now on paid administrative leave, he has spoken to band members a number of times. They have to sign anti-hazing pledges at the start of the school year. So yeah, it has been a problem that they've been struggling with for a while, and I think parents will just tell you they don't think it's under control.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're getting an update on the tragic death of FAMU drum major Robert Champion Jr. He died last year after an alleged hazing incident. Charges were filed yesterday. They're serious ones. They're felony charges. And my guest is Orlando Sentinel reporter Denise Marie Bologna, who's been covering this story. But, you know, back to the investigation and the charges, I think it's also perhaps surprising to some people that there is a charge, a specific charge of hazing. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and what you found out after the charges were made?
Well, there's a state statute that talks about hazing, and Florida is one of the few in the country that has a very strict, specific hazing law. And there, you know, there's misdemeanor hazing, there's felony hazing. Misdemeanor would be, you know, participating in an event that would be hitting or embarrassing someone, whereas a felony would be actually injuring someone, seriously injuring someone, or even killing them as a result of the hazing activities.
What do you have any sense of whether this kind of behavior is going on other campuses in the state? It sounds as though Florida has been thinking about this for some time, and I just wonder if it's having any impact on behavior, if this is something that you're seeing on other campuses in addition to FAMU.
We definitely know that hazing is going on at other campuses around Florida and the country. That's definite. University of Florida has been dealing with some issues very recently. They made some arrests within the last few weeks related to some hazing involving a fraternity at their campus. So we do occasionally hear about hazing involving fraternities and athletic groups, but not so much among marching band members. And I think that's why this has drawn so much attention.
Well, we do hope you'll keep us posted on this. And thank you for your reporting in this.
Thank you, Michelle.
Denise Marie Bologna is a reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. She's been covering the death allegedly by hazing of Robert Champion Jr., a drum major at FAMU. She joined us from member station WMFE in Orlando, Florida. And now we look forward to the weekend. Saturday is Cinco de Mayo. That is the holiday that commemorates Mexico's victory against French invaders in the Battle of Puebla, which might cause you to wonder that has exactly what to do with the huge displays of taco shells, canned beans, and Mexican beer that are going to crowd the grocery aisles this weekend. I don't know. Would the Mexican food industry in America be a multi-billion dollar industry without it? We'll ask our next guest, Gustavo Arellano. His Ask a Mexican column for the OC Weekly has been widely syndicated. He's a longtime food critic. He's also a scholar of Latin American studies, and he's the author of the new book, Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America. Gustavo, welcome back. Congratulations on the book.
Oh, gracias, Michelle. I appreciate it.
Now, Gustavo, let's get something out of the way first. When we last talked about Cinco de Mayo, which was last year, you were such a hater. Remind us again of why you hate Cinco de Mayo.
Cinco de Mayo is an invented holiday that really ultimately means nothing. The assumption is that we're celebrating a David versus Goliath victory and that the Mexican forces in Puebla in 1861 beat back the French army. However, not only did the French beat Mexico the following year and took over France for 4 years, but French culture has profoundly changed Mexico forever. Every time we eat our Mexican sweetbread or pan dulce, it's all French pastries.
Okay. Well, now that you've cleared that up, your book, however, does seem to vindicate Mexican fast food. Have you had a change of heart?
No, it's not that I'm an advocate of fast food now. You know, I used to be a zealot. I used to think, okay, there's quote-unquote real Mexican food and there's fake Mexican food. But no, Mexican food is Mexican food is Mexican food. There's different types of Mexican food, sure. And I'm going to prefer, say, a Oaxacan mole or my mom's grilled cactus, but it's, you know, it's as differently Mexican as fast food is.
So give us the short course. How did Mexican food conquer America, as you put it?
It's been wave after wave of a Mexican invasion of the American palate, going back to the 1880s, where tamale men that started in San Francisco but then spread all across the United States took over American streets. And chili, what we now know as chili, but back then was known as chile con carne, canners in Chicago during the 1890s, they started stuffing it into cans because it had a shelf life and it was cheap. And then after that, it's just one wave after another wave. What the American story with Mexican food is, we've always wanted it because of its great diverse flavors. We eat it, we assimilate it into our diet, and then we say, okay, what's next? I want the next great Mexican food.
Would it be fair to say that you have the same kind of love-hate relationship with Mexican or Tex-Mex food that a lot of, say, African-Americans have with Elvis, which is, you know, on the one hand, you know, yeah, it's its own thing and I can appreciate it, but I still feel like you're stealing my mojo.
Tex-Mex cuisine, it's so reviled by Americans now, which is funny because up until the 1970s, it was just called Mexican food. Then you have the release of a book by Diana Kennedy where she argued that Tex-Mex food was somehow inauthentic because it was Anglos who was eating it. That's the story, though, of all food. The Mexicans were not immune to it as well. In my book, I talked to Larry Cano, who was the founder of El Torito, one of the pioneers of actual Mexican restaurants where you could sit down and have a meal. He's Mexicano, as Mexicano as they come. And he told me that in the 1970s, when he was growing his restaurant, he would have his workers go to Mexican restaurants across the country, work there for 3 weeks, steal all the recipes, get fired, then come back home, and then they would replicate the dishes. So the food industry is cutthroat. You can't just blame white folks on it. Mexicans were as bad as anyone else when it comes to stealing others' foods.
So just to be clear, you're okay with us going out and eating some fritos and salsa and drinking frozen margaritas this weekend?
Yeah, I would prefer that you go to a better Mexican restaurant than your local cantina, not get a frozen margarita, but, you know, try some Corralejo. That's one of my favorite tequilas. It's a sweet, beautiful thing.
But it's kind of a gateway. You're saying that mass-produced stuff is kind of the gateway to the better stuff.
Oh, absolutely. There's always a dish. Americans always know that there's better Mexican food ahead. They know, hey, you know, eventually more Lerum, eventually food trucks, they're going to come to my area. And when that happens, I'm going to drop this mass-produced flop and I'm going to go for the more quote-unquote authentic dishes.
Before we let you go, Gustavo, as you point out, outside of Puebla, most Mexicans don't celebrate Cinco de Mayo. So why do you think Americans love it so much?
Americans like to play ethnics, you know, one time a year, a couple times a year. So they want to get down with, say, Otis Redding. They want to, you know, they want to act like Irish people on St. Patrick's Day. They want to pretend to be wise guys by quoting Sopranos. But do they want to live that life? Of course not. So with Mexicans, the one acceptable day of the year where you could act like a Mexican is Cinco de Mayo. They're not going to do it during the Virgin of Guadalupe, which is basically a Mexican holiday. You're not going to do it with Mexican Independence Day because that actually involves you knowing your history. You're going to do it during Cinco de Mayo when everyone else is doing it. You know, Americans like to play ethnics, and if that means, hey, let's drink and put on sombreros and say arriba, arriba, then might as well do it. But then the rest of the year, we'll just get back to eating our Mexican food while hating the Mexicans who make it.
Okay. So, Gustavo, where will you be dining this weekend, if you don't mind my asking?
Well, I'm going to have a book signing out here in Orange County. And so after that, I'm going to take people to go get some tacos.
Okay. That was Gustavo Arellano. He writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. His latest book is Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America. And he was kind enough to join us from Santa Ana, California. Gustavo, thank you so much.
Gracias.
We've had a great time all this week celebrating Tell Me More's fifth anniversary on the air. And as part of that celebration, we put a call out on Facebook. We wanted to hear from some of our five-year-old listeners. We received hundreds of responses, and here are just a few telling us what's so special about being five.
Hi, my name is Olivia Williams. Being five is so special because 5 years olds are the fastest runners. They have the longest legs and a lot of energy.
Hi, my name is Isaiah Carroll. When I turned 5 years old, I was happy because I got a bunch of Beyblades.
Mama lets me carry the baby. That's my most favorite thing about being five.
Hi, my name is Isla. Being five means I love to sing. Twinkle, twinkle, little star. I forget the words sometimes.
And that was Olivia Williams, Isaiah Carroll, and Isla Brooks, who are all five. And we have just one more that we had to share. This is mom and daughter team Teresa Nemeshani and Marta Hume of Pound Ridge, New York.
What does it mean to be five?
It means that you don't cry, you don't be mean.
Oh, those are wise. So you learned to do those things?
Yes, My brain taught me.
What do you like about being five? What does it mean you can do?
Play with mommy and kiss her and hug her.
And tomorrow we wrap up this anniversary week with a number of five-year-olds right here in the studio with me as we conclude the celebration of our first 5 years on the air. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. When you think harmonica, I bet you think honky-tonk, country, blues, maybe Stevie Wonder giving it some R&B love, but you probably never thought you'd hear this. That is Frédéric Yonnet with the intro from his album In Progress, Read My Lips, the rough cut. It's available now as a digital download. He's actually asking fans to weigh in on the music, titles, and album artwork. It's a bold new concept that brings listeners into his creative process early. And Frédéric Yonnet has collaborated with many musical greats as well, such as Stevie Wonder, of course, Prince, and John Legend. And Frédéric Yonnet joins us now for a special in-studio performance. He's brought the whole band with him as well. Welcome to you all. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Will you mind introducing your friends?
Sure, absolutely. Today on keys, we have Hope Nwachukwu on keyboard. On guitar, Robbie McDonald. On bass, Dennis Turner. And over there on the drums, Chris Bynum on drums.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you for coming. You have a very interesting background. And if you would just tell us a little bit about how you got here. Born in France.
Born in France, raised in several places around France, following my dad through his jobs. Every 4 or 5 years we had to move. But I lived most of my life in Paris, where there's a huge music scene, and that's pretty much where I developed my
style. Your mother has a French Guyanese Creole background.
Correct.
Which of them is musical? From which did you inherit your music gene?
Actually, none of them, unfortunately. But somehow it must have skipped a generation or two because my grandfather on my mother's side was playing 17 instruments. And my grandfather on my father's side, I found out that he was a piano player and also a harmonica player.
And there's a very funny story about how you chose the harmonica, that you'd actually started on drums, but...
But I couldn't carry my drums anywhere I wanted to. I didn't have a car. My neighbors hated me because I was the loud neighbor upstairs. So I had to take on my frustration on something that could fit in my pocket. And, you know, what a better instrument than this? It's inexpensive. It makes people smile. Good choice.
But you also wanted to play the melody, right? And you also kept getting in trouble because you kept kind of...
That's correct. Yeah. I got fired from quite a few bands because I was trying to actually take the lead with the drums, and they were pretty clear about this. They told me a few times, you know, you can't do that, or you have to walk. And I got fired.
Okay. Perhaps you're more forgiving with your own drummer now?
Oh, yeah, he's doing just fine. I actually like the way he plays. He doesn't play like a follower. That's what I like about him.
But talk about the idea of not just bringing the harmonica front and center, but also giving it, as we say, an urban jazz feel. Is that just kind of the sound that you heard in your head, or how did that come about?
I come from the perspective that the music I listen to does not include the harmonica. So I figured that, you know, there were a window there and window of opportunity. It was a pretty simple choice to make. The harmonica is an underestimated instrument, only used in a few different styles of music, which I love and respect a lot. But thank God for me, I can actually take advantage of the fact that nobody is doing exactly what I'm doing. So it keeps me busy.
Well, let's hear a little bit.
Let's see. We just heard a snippet earlier. We can actually develop that a little bit for you, just for, you know, a quick
second.
Sure,
let's hear it.
Give you an idea of where the music comes from and where it's going, and then we'll come back in the conversation.
All right. And you know what I feel really bad about is that people can't see you. Our audience in the studio can see you. And people always write about they use these euphemisms like electrifying stage presence, but that doesn't really capture the fact that you're kind of a wild man up here, like with your kind of like, how do you put all that together? You've got like, and is that choreographed or is that just what occurs to you?
Let's put it this way. The energy it takes for me to express or to actually dig out of my body and deliver to the audience requires sometimes more efforts, more physical effort, and that's what you're witnessing in the motions.
People love it. What are you talking about? That's part of the fun of it. And I understand that you travel with, how many harmonicas do you travel with? I see maybe six up there right now?
I have six stainless steel reeds harmonica. Usually they're made of brass, but those are a lot stronger than the competitors. I usually have like close to 40 Zydol harmonicas in my bag because I break them sometimes. Even though that brand is a lot stronger than the competitors, you know, I'd like to have some spares. Each harmonica has a personality, and sometimes the personality works with you and sometimes it works against you. So.
What do they say when you go through security at the airport?
I mean, can you play us a song?
Do they really?
And my question is, do you have a band?
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We are having a special in-studio performance and conversation with Frédéric Yonnet. You're already releasing cuts from the album, calling it Reed, that's R-E-E-D.
Correct.
Reed, My Lips, The Rough Cut. And you're presenting work in progress. Where did you get the idea to do that?
I found out that people listen to the music differently when they know that they can have an impact on the end result. So I wanted to use this opportunity to share with my audience the creative process at several steps of evolution. And if some of the comments and suggestions coming back to us are actually as constructive as they can be, and if they are great ideas, they will end up on the final mix, and we'll give them credit for that.
Really?
Yeah. Why not?
Because most people don't do that.
It's true. Most people are scared of sharing the work in progress, but I think I can learn from this, and I also want to take people on a journey.
Hmm. Well, let's hear another song. This is Voice. You know, I think Stevie Wonder's played an important role in your career here in the U.S. How did that come about?
Not only in my career, he really had an important role in my life, in my musical evolution. I've always been a big fan of Stevie. I mean, of course, who isn't? But something about his generosity, his overwhelming sense of giving love that you feel in his music, that actually was confirmed when I had an opportunity to meet him. I was introduced to him by Dave Chappelle. We were hanging out backstage at the Grammys in 2006. Dave was there to introduce Sly and the Family Stone. They have been gone for a long time, and he was basically there to bring them back on stage. Mm-hmm. And as we were hanging out backstage with Dave, I actually saw the sign, Stevie Wonder, and I was shaking. I was extremely intimidated, and Dave very nicely introduced us. So we started talking about harmonica, and I asked him what kind of harmonica he uses. He answered, and I asked him if he knew about the brand I'm endorsing, and he said he was not familiar with it. So I was like, hey, let me just show you what it does.
Oh, good for you. Nice move.
One of his songs, and he gave me his phone number, and you know, every time we're in the same city, we hang out and we play together.
What's that like?
Oh, it's like living a dream before you get to dream it. Literally, it's. I mean, in my wildest expectations of life and of evolution in the music business, I would have never imagined meeting him is one thing, but playing with him and then sharing the stage with him is even more overwhelming. And now we're actually talking about doing some work together in the studio, so it's like .
Well, you've been playing with all kinds of people, all kinds of different genres. I know that we've seen you with, as we mentioned, with John Legend and of course, Prince and...
Indy Irie. Idan Riquel. The Jonas Brothers also. I'm really trying to put the harmonica in places where you least expect it.
Yes, you're right. I wouldn't expect it in the Jonas Brothers. So is there any kind of music that you don't think you could apply it to? You think, no, I just can't do it.
When the political involvement is too deep into something that I'm against, yes, definitely. I'll just put it that way.
Okay.
Other than that, I mean, you know, music, there's two kinds of music, like Duke was saying, good and bad music. So, you know, it keeps the doors open.
Yeah, sure. I also wanted to mention that you are one of the Smithsonian's jazz ambassadors.
Correct.
That's kind of exciting, from a kid who kept getting fired from bands in France to now being one of our premier cultural institutions,
ironically,
and being asked to kind of represent your art form.
Ironically, there's going to be a photo exhibit at the headquarters of UNESCO in Paris. I'm a featured artist in that exhibit.
So do you hope any of the people who fired you see it?
I hope that those people are not in the music business anymore.
And one more thing. I understand that the work actually helps you with your asthma, and that you're actually teaching kids to use the harmonica who have asthma as a way to work on that, their breath and their breathing. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Correct. I grew up with asthma, and I always carried an inhaler in my pocket. And when I really started to switch on putting a lot of energy in sharpening my craft as a harmonica player, I realized that I did not need an inhaler as much as I used to the point that I actually totally gave up on it. You know, when you have asthma, if you forget your inhaler, that's when the monkey jumps on your back. And I realized that when that actually took place, it was better for me to pull the harmonica out of my pocket and practice a lot harder. So now I'm doing two things. Not only am I trying to show kids who have asthma that there is an outlet away from medicine, away from medication, that actually is linked to some kind of a meditation. You know, the harmonica, when you hyperventilate, you find yourself in that kind of a packet of meditation sometimes. So, you know, that's one thing that I like to do, but I also like to show kids how they can incorporate the harmonica in the music they listen to, you know, and using it in a creative way and in their own way.
Well, thank you for coming. We sure enjoyed visiting with you. I'm going to ask you to play one more thing first, but tell us about the album. As we mentioned, it's a work in progress, and you're actually asking listeners to participate in the creative process. When do you think you'll have the final cut ready?
We're thinking about getting that together before September. Then by next year, hopefully, the album will be released in its final mixed version, and for the final mix, it will be released everywhere.
What are you going to play to, as we say goodbye? What are you going to play to... Send us off.
This is it? This is the last tune?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Okay. Well, I enjoyed myself so much. I'm sorry.
You know, time is the one thing they're not making more of. So
we're going to play a track right now. I think it's letter D on the download.
Letter
card.
D?
Yeah.
Frédéric Yonnet plays the harmonica. His album In Progress is called Read. That's R-E-E-D. Read My Lips, The Rough Cut. Fans can download the latest material from his website and leave feedback. Thank you so much for visiting with us, and good luck to you.
Michelle, thank you for having us. Thank you.
You've been listening to Frédéric Yonnet playing pieces from his album in progress, Read My Lips, The Rough Cut. And that's our program for today. And once a week, we take time for credits. That's where we recognize the work of the Tell Me More staff. But there are so many other people who helped make this program possible that we decided we wanted to share our fifth anniversary celebration with them. Today, we're thanking some of the NPR executives, including Margaret Lowe Smith, Kinsey Wilson, Ellen McDonald, and David Sweeney. And Tell Me More is produced this week by Freddie Boswell, Bridget Deshagas, Andrew Limbong, Sanaj Meshkinpour, Emily Oxenschlager, Amitha Parasher, Amy Ta, and Kenya Young. Our intern is Bridget Armstrong. Our editors are Alicia Montgomery and Ahmad Omar. Our director is Arjun Hutchins. Our senior producer is Devar Ardalan. The technical director is Neil Tevold. He had a hand this week from Sean Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior editor is Portia Robertson-Migas. Our executive producer is Tashima Walker. And remember, to tell us more, please go to npr.org and find us under the Programs tab. You can find our podcast there. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Tell Me More NPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow.